BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the activist and teacher Sinead Burke. Education and fashion have been her twin passions since childhood. Her life story is one of style and substance. Sinead knew she wanted to teach when she was at primary school and soon after started to ask for back issues of Vogue magazine for her birthday. After training as a teacher, she launched a successful fashion blog and last year appeared on the cover of the magazine she had been collecting since childhood, honouring her pioneering campaigns for equality and inclusion for people who, like her, have disabilities. Sinead has achondroplasia, a genetic condition which causes restricted growth, and is 3 feet 5 inches tall. At 29, she's taken her message to the White House at the invitation of the Obamas and a little closer to home to the Irish president, advising him as part of his Council of State. She says, "I grew up with parents who always told me that anything I wanted to do could be achieved. I may have to find a different route to do it because of my disability, but it didn't mean that obstacles couldn't be overcome. It was incredibly empowering at such a young age to get that understanding." Sinead Burke, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
This is such a treat and an honour, and I can barely believe that I'm here, but thank you so much for that wonderful introduction.
Well, I think it's probably wise that we start with some of the language. How language is used is very important to you. You've said that it can be a force for good and it can be something less so. Tell me a little bit more about that.
When I was growing up, I used to define myself and describe myself as just Sinead, and never really seeing myself as disabled or using that language. Actually, what I was doing was erasing my disability and attaching shame and stigma to it, probably because I had been taught to do that by the world. And I am now very proudly a disabled woman. And for me, as a little person, that's the terminology that I prefer.
You successfully campaigned to get the Irish Language Dictionary to include a direct translation of little person. Tell me how that came about.
Part of being a teacher and a primary school teacher in Ireland, you have to study Irish. And I remember being kind of 17 doing my final year exams and having to go into the oral exam. And the first question that you're usually asked in that environment is Inis dom fuadsa, 3 Irish words that mean tell me about yourself. And I remember being nervous, not necessarily about the exam, but because I couldn't describe myself in language that I was comfortable with. And I ended up calling myself a dwarf, not a word that I use in English, but had to pass the exam. And I was afraid of making something up and being marked down. And when I finished school and was in college and graduated, I kind of thought, you know, there has to be a way to change this. Language has to evolve. So boldly, I just emailed Fergus na Gaeilge, who is the government department responsible for the Irish language. And the direct translation of little person is Dhuine Beag. And within 48 hours, it was in the dictionary. And wow. Sometimes you just have to ask.
You're hugely passionate and very persuasive. You know, we can hear that. And you're also not shy about buttonholing the people that you need to get on your side. You know, celebrities, journalists, people that are kind of crossing your paths at parties and different events. Where does the confidence to do that come from? Have you always had it?
I describe myself as an extroverted introvert. I am never happier than being in my own company with a book or listening to some music. But the world has made me be an extrovert. You know, from the earliest of ages, I was the centre of attention because I would often be the only person who looked like me in a room or in a space. And I knew from the earliest of ages that if I wanted to thrive in this space, I would have to get really good at stepping outside of my own discomfort and introducing myself. Hi, I'm Sinead. I'm 4 years old. I think we should go play in the playhouse. Do you want to come? And that was just a thing that I practiced, and I've had 2 decades of practice, so I'm really good at it now.
We've got an incredibly uplifting playlist to look forward to, Sinead, I have to say. Tell us about your first choice today.
My first choice is by the extraordinary Lizzo, Like a Girl. because she is proud of who she is and the body that she lives in. And her anthems tell us, however you define yourself, whatever way you feel, that's valid, that's real, and you're enough as you are. Woke up feeling like I just might run for president. Even if there ain't no precedent, switching up the messaging. I'm about to add a little estrogen. Buy my whip by myself, pay my rent by myself. Only exes that I care about are all up in my chromosomes. I don't really need you. I'm a Macaulay Culkin, home alone. Bad bitch, diamonds in my collarbone. Yeah, yeah. Buy my whip by myself, pay my rent by myself. Sugar, spice, and I'm
Lizzo and Like a Girl. So, Sinead Burke, you've described the public bathroom as a symbol of human rights. Why? What does its design represent to you?
The right to dignity is so important, and yet so often not considered. My experience of going to a public bathroom in a shopping centre is really difficult and complicated. You know, from the moment I kind of get to the women's bathrooms and to the cubicles, I probably can't reach the lock on the door. And often I will take off a coat and try to stand on it or use my phone to close the lock or try to step on a bin. And when I use the bathroom and come out, you know, I also can't reach the sink. Particularly in a moment where we've just experienced a pandemic, we're realising that those points of hygiene are more crucial than ever. And actually, what I need in that moment is a lower sink. And I think we have become so focused designing a world for one specific type of person that our lens has been so narrow. And actually, if we widened it to include a whole host of people, we'll realise really quickly that that has benefit and value for everybody.
You talked about attracting attention. What form does it take and how do you handle it?
It manifests in all sorts, from being pointed at, stared at. People will often take photographs or videos without your consent. I had an instance in Dublin late last year where I was just walking down the street and two 16-year-old boys walked past me. It was a Tuesday afternoon about 12 o'clock. And about 30 seconds later, one of them leapfrogged over me from behind, jumped from the ground over my head to the other side of me, all the while his accomplice recorded the entire thing on his phone. I mean, the first person I rang was my mom, and I was just crying. They just didn't even see me as a person. I think with my teaching background, I realised that if those two young boys were caught, the only thing that they would learn in that moment is, well, not to get caught. They wouldn't actually learn about the human impact that it had. So I called a friend, and he was working for this community organisation in the north side of Dublin. And I said, how do we get into every school in the area in which this happened? He kind of laughed at me and I said, no, I'm being entirely serious. And we did. I went to every primary school and every secondary school in that area. And I spoke to hundreds, if not thousands of students and shared parts of my life. I gave a TED talk in New York in 2017. Those students, particularly at the age of 16, have to sit the junior cert in Ireland. And my TED talk was part of their English exam. And they had to answer questions on my life for their exam. So let's just look at that full circle there. You jump over a person in the middle of the street, and then she arrives into your school 48 hours later and you're like, oh no, oh God. And then your entire English exam result is based on you answering factually correct questions and answers based on her life. I mean, it's quite a conundrum.
It's time for your next piece of music, Sinead. What's it going to be? Disc number two, why have you chosen it?
My TED Talk was probably, and still is, one of the scariest things that I've ever done. I was in New York on my own and I couldn't remember it. There was no auto cue. And I remember just feeling violently unwell about the whole occasion. A half an hour to go, I stood in front of the mirror and told myself, no one can give this talk better than you can, because this is your story. So why don't you just enjoy it? So I went and I did my TED Talk and it changed my life. But straight after I finished speaking, the musical guest came on and it was Sophie Tucker, an amazing electropop duo based out of New York. And they sang the song called A Woo. About 6 months later, they came to Dublin to perform, and I performed this song with them on Tucker's shoulders. Now, Tucker used to be a basketball player, so he was around and is around 6'7" in height. So on his shoulders, it was both the most dangerous thing and the most fun thing that I've ever done. But this song holds a really special place in my heart.
There and then I quit.
Sophie Tucker featuring Better Lem with Awu. So Sinead Burke, you were born in Dublin in 1990. Your dad, Chris, was an actor. Tell me a little bit about him.
Like me, he's also a little person. When my parents were having children, because my mum is average height and my dad is little, for all of their children there was a 50-50 chance if they would have somebody who was little or if they would have somebody who was tall. And of the five of us, I'm the only one with dwarfism. And I had this incredible example of my ability to survive and thrive because my dad had done. And my dad is an extrovert too. I think also because the world made him be one. And he is my greatest advocate along with my mom. And they are just the most supportive people. And I think if I am in any way a success, it is genuinely because I'm a loved child. My parents in 1997 made a documentary for Ireland's national broadcaster called It's a Small World. And thankfully, due to the age in which it was made, does not exist on any iPlayer. And it was this day in the life of my family and I. And from it, lots of other families got in touch and says, we have a daughter or a son, or I look like you, our family looks like yours. It was a reaction that my parents really weren't expecting, but felt a responsibility to do something about that. And in 1997, founded Little People of Ireland, and still to this day, voluntarily run that organisation. You know, they have not just changed my world by building this community, but a whole country's.
That balance between protecting you and overprotecting you, how did they find that idea of encouraging your independence while also looking out for you?
My parents, if they did anything, was encourage me to have my own voice. You know, I talked before I could walk, which is not a surprise to anybody who knows me. And they were always just so confident in me. I had this bizarre arrogance about what I could do with the world because they never gave me their fears. And then when I got a bit older, they knew when it was time to step back, when it was time for me to fight those battles myself.
What's family life like when you're all together? You know, you're at home right now.
Chaos. Pure, absolute chaos. You know, that's where I become more introverted and my siblings become more extroverted, but it's great.
Time for your next disc, Sinead. What's it going to be and why?
One of the tracks that I can't listen to without thinking of my parents is this one. Bronska Beat, Small Town Boy. It's one of their favourites and I wouldn't be able to do Desert Island Discs without honouring them.
Bronski Beat and Small Town Boy. Sinead Burke, when you were just 11, you were offered the opportunity to have surgery to lengthen your limbs. What would that operation have involved?
It would have involved the deliberate fracturing of my lower leg bones. And over the course of a year, I would have been responsible through pins in my legs and through twisting those pins a quarter of an inch every day, stretching that fracture apart further so that new marrow and new bone could grow, resulting in hopefully 3 to 6 inches of height. And in terms of my parents' bravery, this was one of the moments that still shines brightly for me because they didn't try to make my decision for me. They listened to my concerns or questions or interests. They helped me book appointments with clinicians, but they told me that it had to be my decision. And kind of the more I thought about it, the more I realised that actually the reason why I would be doing it would be to skew slightly closer to the world's definition of normality. And that might make it easier to make friends. But at 11, I decided that if people didn't want to be my friend because I was a little person, they weren't the kind of friends that I needed in my life. And I just told my parents and said, I've decided I'm not getting the surgery. If people don't like me, that's their fault. I'm great. My parents were like, lovely. That's I'm thrilled for you. So we'll cancel that surgery date. Great. And I think that put me in a really good position going into my teen years to believe in myself.
What about nights out with friends when you're a teenager, Sinead? They're a crucial part of growing up. How did you navigate that when you were out clubbing?
I love music and I love to dance, but that wasn't always possible. And I had experiences in my late teens, early 20s, where people would, with a few drinks in them, come over. They would pick me up, they would throw me in the air, and they thought it was funny. And it made me feel so unsafe. But I found a safe space.
Where was it?
And that was the gay and the queer communities in Dublin. I went to the George, which is this amazing legendary club in Dublin. And I remember being really nervous getting up to dance for the first time because I knew I was going to be looked at and I just would be so conscious of being observed. And it was amazing because nobody cared because everybody was different. And it was just so freeing. And I remember turning to my friends at the end of the night and going, is this how you feel every night out clubbing? Because like, I get it. Like, I finally get it. I'm in. Like, count me in. Every Saturday, I'm here. It was really powerful.
It's time to go to the music, Sinead. Tell us about your next disc.
I got to go to the Met Gala last year in May. And I was the second ever disabled person to be in attendance and the first little person to ever go. I spent the whole morning and afternoon lying on my hotel room floor, been sick and violently unwell because I was just so nervous. And it sounds so ridiculous. I remember ringing home and I called my dad and I was like, Dad, I don't think I can go. And he said, Sinead, what are you talking about? It's a party in a museum. You'll have a great time. Go to the party. And it was just the sense of reality that I needed as I was walking up the steps between like Mindy Kaling and Anna Wintour. I wore this amazing full-length velvet dress and I wore a crown. And the only thing that really got me through that moment in a way was listening to Billie Eilish's You Should See Me in a Crown, because I was trying to embody her confidence in a moment in which I was just disgustingly nervous. You should see me in a crown. I'm gonna run, there's nothing to hold. Watch me make them bow. One by one by one. One by one by. You should see me in a crown. Your silence is my favorite sound. Watch me make them bow. One by one by one. One by one by. Billie Eilish and You Should See Me in a Crown. So Sinead Burke, you talked about finding your place on the dance floor in the club scene, Dublin's LGBTQ plus nightclub scene. In 2012, you entered the Alternative Miss Ireland contest, which is organised by the LGBTQ community in Dublin. Quite a bold move. What made you decide to have a crack at that? It was a pageant style performance competition for the queer community, but it was a fundraiser for HIV and AIDS charities. I wanted to thank the queer community for not just welcoming me and accepting me, but for giving me permission to discover who I was. So I retold the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, but from my perspective. I stood on a 4-foot platform. I had a 7-foot Snow White skirt, and a narration began that said, once upon a time, in a land far away, lived a little girl who actually wasn't gay. But why did she enter? I hear you all say. Was she alternative? Why, yes, she was born this way. The lights went up. 7 tall dwarfs came striding out on stage. They ripped my skirt, lifted me down off the platform. And very quickly it became obvious that this was no ordinary fairy tale. And the first half closed with my mother dressed as the Wicked Queen, giving me an apple to Nina Simone's I Put a Spell on You. The second half opened with me in my prom and my Debs dress in a glass coffin, and my dad, dressed as Prince Charming, coming across the stage to the traditional Snow White music. We got a standing ovation from 1,600 people and was genuinely the greatest night of my life. I never expected to win. I genuinely just wanted to find a way to say thanks and to stand on that stage of so many people who had felt different or been made to feel different their whole lives. There was just such love and pride. And it was that turning point, along, I think, with the confidence that I had gained from that, that in many ways changed everything.
I think we better hear some music, Sinead. What's it going to be?
There are so many songs that could mark that moment, but it's going to have to be Nina Simone's I Put a Spell on You.
I put a spell on you. Cause you're mine. Do, 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 do. You
Nina Simone and I Put a Spell on You. Sinead Burke, education is one of your greatest passions. How old were you when you decided that you wanted to become a primary school teacher?
It was the day of my fourth birthday, which also happened to be my first day of school. I was absolute in my decision.
So you never had any doubts and your parents were obviously hugely supportive. Did anybody else express any scepticism about this choice of career?
You know, when I started in university, I remember sitting in a lecture and one of the other students kind of sitting beside me and turning to me and saying, you know, how are you going to be a teacher? The kids are going to be bigger than you. How are you going to get the respect? And it did make me worry that it wouldn't be possible. But while so many were focused on why my disability would make me a bad teacher, it was actually in many ways what made me a good, if not great, teacher. And yeah, there were challenges. I mean, I couldn't reach the artwork on the wall to hang it up. So the students that I taught just became the curators of our art classroom. And I couldn't reach the blackboard. So I taught using a laptop and a projector.
The kids must have had lots of questions for you and that natural curiosity that you mentioned earlier about your size. How did you handle that?
You know, I'd walk into the room and straight away a hand would go up and they'd say something like, why are you so small? Which is a really great question for a four-year-old to ask. And I would say, well, why are you so big? And they'd say, I don't know. I was born like this. And I'd say, well, yeah, so was I. And they go, oh, what page are we on? And finding that connection between them and me, you know, they didn't get to choose what colour their hair was or what gender they were born or what family they were born into. And realising that neither did I had this transformative impact in the entire classroom. And we just created this space of openness where people could ask anything.
Let's go to the music, Sinead. What's next?
At the end of every lesson, I would link my computer to my iTunes library. And somebody who had demonstrated, I don't know, maybe it was they tried a bit harder at a subject today, or you know what, they made a big deal of their homework. That person would get to listen to 90 seconds of a song. But everybody was trying to prove how cool they were. So we listened to like a lot of Ed Sheeran and Calvin Harris for like the first 3 weeks. And I remember one of the boys who often demonstrated some of the most challenging behaviour in the class. He came up to me one day and he said, do you have Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel? And he said, oh, it's played all the time at home. It's my dad's favourite song. So I went home, I bought the song, and a couple of days later, it was his time, it was his moment. And he said, will you play that song? And it began to echo out over the classroom. Most of the other kids didn't know it and they were basically saying that it was terrible. And he said, no, this is important to me. It's important to my dad. It's his favourite song. And the next song that was asked for was Sinead O'Connor's Nothing Compares to You. And then The Dubliners, and then Thin Lizzy. It was becoming a way to bring home and school so together. You know, so many of these parents felt like school wasn't a place for them. Perhaps their own literacy levels were not where they thought it needed to be, and they didn't feel like they could interact with school in the way that it should have been open to everybody. But music and this moment changed everything in my classroom. So I didn't need to control the students. I just needed to respect them.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
The Sound of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. Sinead Burke, let's talk about fashion then. We haven't really covered it yet. You challenge it to be more inclusive. You want to hold fashion to account. I've seen pictures of you in some amazing designer outfits. It's clear that clothes and style mean a lot to you.
Hugely. You know, I think for so much of my life, if somebody had asked me what my sense of style was, I would have almost said like it was kind of monochromatic with a focus on accessories. And that was because I didn't really get to choose what I wore. I was either in the children's department, which was infantilizing, or I was in the basics in women's wear, whether it was a pair of black jeans and a white top, and that's all I could get and all that would be altered. And I found these amazing pink pair of moccasins that I have wore to death. And I think they should probably be cremated at this stage, but they were the first item in my wardrobe that gave me any sense of personality or character. They were still a flat shoe. I'm a size 12 UK in the children's department, so getting high heels and getting shoes that hint to my maturity are often a challenge. But It was kind of the first time that I knew it was possible. Feeling the joy of clothes that fit you, both physically and in terms of your personality, is just something that I want the world to experience and people who have never experienced to have the privilege to do so. And when people looked at me, they decided who I was based on my body. And I wanted fashion to be a tool to redefine that, and yet I couldn't access it. But my way in was through education, because I quickly understood that in terms of the fashion industry, trends and being interested in being a traditional influencer that, you know, wears lovely clothes and gets photographed in them wasn't something that I could participate in, because those clothes were not in my wardrobe and designers did not consider me when they made them. So I would dive in and spend any free time that I had in my early 20s reading everything I could about the system of the industry, with this overall aspiration that it would help me gain access to it. And I started writing a blog.
I mean, the fashion industry hasn't always been accepting of those who don't fit with its quite narrow definition of beauty. There's a lot of discussion about diversity now. What do you think still needs to be communicated to designers and magazine editors? And what kind of impact do you think that you've been able to have so far?
I think we've seen great advancements in the visibility of diversity. That's all I wanted when I was 16 and getting the September issue of Vogue for my birthday every year, was to open up the pages of that magazine and see somebody who looked anything like me or in any way different. But I think going forward, we need to push past the notion of visibility as success. I want to see design schools becoming more affordable, or grants or bursaries being made specifically to encourage minority voices. I want 10-year-olds to believe that they can be a fashion designer or a fashion writer or a model if they choose to be.
Last year, you were featured on the cover of Vogue, the first little person ever to be featured on any edition of Vogue's cover. And I know that parents of children who also have achondroplasia have sent you photographs of their kids holding the magazine close to themselves. How does it feel to see something like that?
It just makes the most difficult moments worth it, you know? That's why you keep going, why you keep doing it in the moments where people are being unkind and treating you like less and leapfrogging you in public. Like, why bother? Why not do something easier? Why not go back to the classroom full time? And then you realize that maybe even just for a second, you make a child's life easier, or you give them permission to dream that they can do it too. Or parents who have just been told that their new baby has dwarfism, and they find an image of you in Google Images at the Met Gala and they think, maybe it's going to be okay.
Sinead, let's go to the music. What are we going to hear?
Very cheesily. It would be ridiculous to not have a song on this playlist that doesn't hint towards fashion in some way. So this is Madonna's Vogue.
Madonna and Vogue. Sinead Burke, you no longer teach full time. Do you miss being in the classroom?
Oh, I miss it desperately. I still visit classrooms, particularly if there's little people or disabled people enrolled, and I'll go and visit. In weird ways, I think my job now is still being a teacher. I think my students are just like CEOs and creative directors of fashion companies and corporations. And sometimes they are more troublesome than 12-year-olds and vice versa. But I think the skills that I learned in the classroom are exactly what is making me successful at the work that I'm doing right now.
What does success look like to you?
It sounds really glib to say that success looks like unemployment, because either we have all of those issues solved, or a whole generation of advocates behind me are also doing that work. And it's not just advocates alone, but allies too. But I choose to do this for now. My hope is that I won't always have to choose to do it, because the work will be done. What I'll do then, I don't know. I'll have to get my dad to give me advice about getting a real job.
And as we've talked about today, you're very used to dealing with challenging physical environments. How do you think you'll cope on our desert island?
I will go between joyously celebrating my own company and irritating myself with the voice in my head and desperately wanting to talk to the people I love most.
And what about fashion? I mean, obviously, opportunities to express yourself that way will be rather limited.
I'd have a trunk load of clothes with me, or actually, you know, do that wonderful thing that some people do and just board the plane with my entire wardrobe on me. You know, like the Met Gala dress as the base, and then maybe like a custom tuxedo, and then over that, I think, you know, a flouncy A-line skirt. So I'll be absolutely sweating on the plane, but have an array of outfit choices when I land, which I think is a good use.
Sinead, this is a very optimistic vision of your desert island, and I hate to disappoint you, but I'm staunch on this point. Honestly, you will go with one luxury item only. We'll get to that in a minute, though. For now, we've got one more disc to hear, your final selection, if you would. What's it going to be, and why have you chosen it?
I get to travel a lot, but I miss home. And one of my best memories is being in a car with a friend in a cab and looking at the New York skyline as we drove down the quay of the river. Both of us Irish, both of us wanting to be at home and listening to this song, which is the gloaming's Saoire Saoire, which is the Irish word for summer. And just for 3 minutes, feeling like we weren't so far away.
Saoire Saoire, banging the morning, Hogamore Fane and Saoire Lean, Saoire Buin and Onin Glegal, Hogamore Fane and Saoire Lean, Hogamore Linge Ochil Crevy,
Saoire Saoire by The Gloaming. Sinead Burke, it's time to cast you away. You can take the books with you, of course, to keep you company. The Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare will help you pass the time. You can also take a book of your choice. What would you like?
I am going to take Your Silence Will Not Protect You by Audre Lorde, who is one of the writers that I have learned so much from about speaking truth to power, systemic injustices, and the fact that until we are all free, none of us are really free.
What about a luxury item to make your time on the island that little bit more enjoyable?
All of the women in my family are connected via a beautiful necklace that we each wear. It was gifted to us on our 18th birthdays, and we collectively gifted my mother one. And I think being on a distant desert island, it would be a lovely piece of luxury, but also a piece of my family to carry with me.
It's yours. And if you could only save one disc from being swept out to sea, which one would you choose out of the 8 that you've shared with us today?
I think it's going to have to be Lizzo, Like a Girl. When I am muddled in my mind with all of the thoughts and questions that might be circumnavigating around it, the best reprieve one can have in that moment is to dance joyously and embarrassingly. And I'm always doing that when Lizzo is around.
Sinead Burke, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island discs.
Thank you.
We leave Sinead then to dance like there's nobody watching, and there won't be. I hope you enjoyed listening to her story. If you'd like to hear more from other campaigners who've been cast away, you'll find them on BBC Sounds or via the Desert Island Discs website. Among them are Doreen Lawrence, Ben Helfgott and Wangari Maathai. In 2001, Sue Lawley cast away the Olympian and politician Tani Grey Thompson.
ABBA and Waterloo. You obviously, Tani Grey Thompson, intended to be serious about sport from quite early on. You'd started doing athletics at school. You went to Loughborough University, which is known for its sport, although you're reading politics. When did you decide, though, it was really not a hobby, it was something you could make a career out of?
It was probably only really when I was at university. Up until that point, the profile of wheelchair racing wasn't that high, and I had always presumed that I was going to have to get a fairly decent job to be able to pay for my hobby. And then as I was coming towards the end of my time at Loughborough, I'd improved tremendously. I'd been to Seoul, and I knew that's what I wanted to do.
You'd won a bronze at Seoul by then.
Yeah, in the 400, and for me that was probably the point in my career where I realised I could get a lot better.
Because it was the first time you'd really performed, as it were, in front of tens of thousands of people, wasn't it?
Seoul was just the most amazing experience. I was 19, and although I'd been to internationals and different games, really all the travelling I'd done had been in Europe and in the States. And actually going to a country like Korea, which is such a completely different culture, was a huge eye-opener for me. And I remember we had a little bit of time at the end of the games, sort of going shopping in sort of downtown Seoul. And you could be, it was the sort of richest shopping district in the city. And on the street corners, there were 16-year-old prostitutes with needle marks. And that for me, as a 19-year-old, you know, grew up in Cardiff and had never seen very much, was a huge shock.
And what about nerves at the games themselves? Because you do suffer from nerves, don't you, for all your great success.
And I think I get worse as I get older. I get very nervous, and I've never really found a way of dealing with it. So,
how nervous? What form does it take?
Nervous. I get sick. I throw up before I race. You know, that bad.
Always?
Virtually always.
So it still happened in Sydney. I mean, even when you were clocking up those four goals in a row, presumably particularly before the last one, the 400 metres, wasn't it, the last one, as we say. Did anyone then suggest to you, look, forget it, give up, stop?
Well, one of my coaches, part of me being an athlete, I actually like being at the warm-up track way ahead of time because just in case things go wrong, you know, I'm a great what-if. So I was sitting at the track about 2 hours before I had to start warming up, just chatting to one of the team coaches, and I just said to him, I don't want to do this anymore. I feel so sick. I know I'm going to have to spend the next half an hour in the toilet. And he said, well, why are you doing it? And I don't know, really. He said, well, if you actually had the choice and someone came along now and would take you away from this and you never had to do it again, would you go? And I said, don't be so stupid, of course I wouldn't. So it's this kind of split personality in athlete. You just don't want to do it, and it's the worst feeling. I actually start feeling ill thinking about it now, just the waiting, because I don't like waiting for things.
Tanny Gray-Thompson speaking to Sue Lawley in 2001. Next time, I'll be casting away the conductor, Charles Hazlewood. I do hope you'll join us then.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Greg Jenner. Usually I host the You're Dead to Me podcast and work on horrible histories, but while we're all cooped up indoors, I'm presenting a new podcast for the whole family. It's called Homeschool History, and every episode is a fun 15-minute guide to a fascinating historical subject. It's cheery, informative, and suitable for anyone who likes silly jokes and funny sound effects. And who doesn't? We'll have episodes on the Restoration, the Space Race, Charles Dickens, Florence Nightingale, Stone Age Britain, and plenty more. So that's Homeschool History with me, Greg Jenner, on BBC Sounds.